Welcome to the Advance Your Art podcast, where we talk about the journey from artist to entrepreneur and everything in between. You've worked hard to hone your craft. Now take it to the next level with tips, techniques, strategies, and routines used by successful artists to grow their businesses and careers. Now, let's get started and have some fun with your host, Yuri Cataldo.
Episode 3 of the Advance Your Art Podcast. I'm your host, Yuri Cataldo. Today's interview will be with the multi-talented saxophonist, Bob Reynolds. Before we get into that, while I don't have any official sponsors for this podcast, there are a lot of products that I like to use, so I thought, why not take the opportunity to talk about it? When I first moved to Boston, I was looking for things to do in the evening, especially since I didn't have an apartment and was living at various Airbnbs. I signed up to drive for Lyft, and it was an interesting experience and was the most eventful during Halloween, which is probably why I don't do it anymore. But either way, if you've never used the car service before, I highly recommend Lyft over Uber, mostly probably just because I drove for Lyft. Anyway, if you've never used them before, you can sign up on their website at lyft.com or download their app. If you use the promo code COMEPICKMEUP, all one word, and yes, it's just like the Ryan Adams song, you can get $50 worth of free credits that you can use at any time. So lyft.com, download the app, promo code COMEPICKMEUP, just like the Ryan Adams song. So without further ado, here we go with Bob Reynolds. So Bob is not your traditional saxophonist. He is very comfortable in an arena full of rock fans or an intimate jazz club setting. He spent years touring the world with John Mayer's band, and we talk a little bit about that in the podcast and how he met John, which was actually at Berklee. But in addition to John, he's worked with dozens other performers, Usher, Josh Groban, the Jonas Brothers, Amos Lee, and Willie Nelson, just to name a few. At the same time that he was recording and working with these rock stars, he also stayed true to his jazz roots and played in small clubs across the United States, and three of his five albums actually were recorded live in those jazz clubs. So in addition to being a wonderfully talented saxophonist, he also started his own company and teaches people how to play saxophone online. And it's a website that he coded himself, which I find to be absolutely amazing. And we get into a lot more about that in the interview. So without further ado, I give you the multi-talented Bob Reynolds. What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had two pieces of really delicious, like, some sort of cakey bread with icing on it that came from a bakery.
Oh, that's awesome. That sounds really good.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. Yeah. I'm generally a light breakfast eater. I like the European style kind of like sweet bready type thing, and then eat more at lunch. I'm not really good at that. Breakfast is your most important meal of the day, like eat a bunch of healthy stuff.
Oh, sure. You know what? I'm the same kind of way. Although, do you do it just because of some kind of dietary thing, or is that just your
natural? No, I just do it because it's just like food for me is like, I don't get me wrong, I enjoy really good food, but most of the time it's a necessity, and I always feel like I have other stuff I have to get to, and then it's like, oh, shoot, I got to eat too. So it's like the lowest on the totem pole in terms of priorities. It's like, get up, get the daughter to preschool. I should probably eat something too.
sure. Yeah, I totally get that. All right, Bob. Well, thank you so much and welcome to the show. It's fantastic. Fantastic to have you here. So I just want to start off with just getting to know a little bit more about you. So if we were to meet at a party, how would you introduce yourself?
I would probably just go with the saxophonist and then start adding various, you know, levels of classification. But saxophonist, jazz saxophonist, something along those lines.
And do you get, when you say that to people, do you get a, what kind of response do you get from somebody?
You know, for your average kind of group of people who are just way outside of that world, it's, it always tends to be sort of like a head tilt and a raised eyebrow, kind of like, oh, really? kind of thing, like, oh, wow. And then it's very often followed by like, professionally, or you know that's what you do, that kind of thing. I that happened less when I lived in New York and was around, you know, mostly like a different community of people. It was like a less surprising thing. But I live in LA now, and so very often, you know, like, oh, what, that's an interesting
profession. Sure, yeah, it's like, do people actually do that kind of a thing?
Is that actually a thing?
Great. Yeah. Okay, great. What originally got you involved or get you into playing the saxophone?
I've told this story a lot, and I try to make it shorter every time. So I'm going to try to give you my best version of it. It wasn't like a burning, or a long standing yearning to play the saxophone. It was really rather, when I was about 13 and I entered, in junior high, you got to pick electives band there. I only had three choices: band, home ec, like home economics, or wood shop. And at that time, I wanted to learn to play an instrument just so that I could learn to compose my own music, because at that point in time, I was really into making, I thought I was going to be a film director. I was like making home movies and including all my friends in the neighborhood and things. And the one thing I could not do myself was write my own music for these little movies. So I thought, oh, if I learn an instrument, any instrument, then I'll be like John Williams by next weekend, and I can just make these fabulous scores for my own movies. And when I was going to go into band, and I thought, well, I'll play the clarinet, because the trumpet, the brass thing didn't really make sense to me. I said, just give me a clarinet. We were going to rent a clarinet. And my mom was telling my neighbor this, and she said, well, you know, we have a saxophone in the attic that my daughter used to play, and if Bob wants that, he can have it. And she asked me, and I was like, sure, why not? And so I took the saxophone, and I think because I was so eager to just get to the making music part, I just sort of looked at the book and put it together and took it in the bathroom and started playing it. And that was the beginning of me playing saxophone.
Wow. So did the bathroom give you better acoustics or privacy?
I don't know if I'd read that or heard that, but somehow I just was like, the natural reverb element, you know, seemed like the place to go. I mean, I can't remember why initially I figured that out, but it was like, ooh, cool. If I go in here, it instantly sounds better.
That idea. Maybe I should start, because I play piano a little bit. Maybe I should drag the piano into the bathroom.
You got to move the piano into the bathroom, Yuri. That's the way to do it.
I think that's the key. I might need a smaller piano to fit in the bathroom door, though.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. So you were on this path and learning saxophone. What got you then from learning sax into going to Berklee for music?
So I played the saxophone just sort of, I mean, I started to get more and more into it. I was just in, you know, your regular like junior high band, concert band thing. But, I didn't know there was a name for it at the time, but I was constantly making up my own music. I knew very early on that I really enjoyed just making music along with what I was hearing. So for instance, I would sit in band, and rather than read the sheet music, that was in front of me, I would just listen to what the concert band was playing, and I would invent my own parts. I later found out that there was a name for this called improvisation, but at the time I didn't know that's what it was. And as I just kind of kept getting more and more into it, we found out there was a performing arts high school. This was in Jacksonville, Florida, and there was a performing arts high school there. We saw them play a show, and it was like a light bulb went off in my mind. I said, I have to go to that school. Those players are amazing, and they're only a year or two ahead of me. So I auditioned, I got in, and that was called Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, and that was for me 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And I would say in 10th grade, I was fortunate to meet some great mentors in town, other people just a little older than me, college age. It just was a really good scene, and I just started advancing quicker, practicing a lot, getting positive feedback. And I think I decided in that 10th grade, you know, I was going to really go for this as a profession. And, you know, when it came time to start looking at colleges, there's certainly it boils down to a handful or so of like what the top jazz schools are. And I ended up going to Berklee in Boston.
That's great. So how was your experience at Berklee?
It was fantastic. I mean, I honestly can trace pretty much everything I've done since professionally, can trace it back to Berklee, to the people I met there. You know, I mean, I had great teachers and great experiences, but the community of people that that I was in school with and had the chance to just, it's not so much work with, but just, you know, play with, meet, hang around, form relationships with, everything I've done since kind of spiderwebs its way back to that time.
After you finished Berkeley, where did you go after that, and what did you do to continue growing as an artist?
So, it was like to be a jazz or an aspiring jazz saxophonist, New York City is sort of the mecca for all things jazz. So that was always I don't even want to say the back of my mind. It was sort of in the front of my mind. One of the reasons I went to Berkeley was because I knew I wanted to go to New York, but I didn't feel ready to go straight out of high school. And Boston felt like a nice, sort of stepping stone to New York. So when I left Berkeley, I knew I was going to New York. There was really no question in my mind. And I graduated Berkeley and moved to New York in the fall of 2000. And I was there for almost 9 years. And as far as continuing to grow, I mean, that the move to that city was like the biggest ass kicker that there possibly could be. I mean, I just kept trying to, like, from, like, you know, even to go back to junior high, I was playing the sax, recognized I was good at it. Then I saw that arts high school and recognized that those were people who were better than I. And I was like, I got to go there. And then when I was looking at colleges, I just kept trying to be this small fish in a big pond thing, you know, and then like going like, okay, when I was done with Berkeley, I was playing better. You know, I was sort of at the top of that thing. And I was like, all right, on to the next place where I will be low man on the totem pole. And, you know, that for me is just always like has led to growth.
So you've always continually reached out to people who are more talented than you to learn from?
Yeah, I mean, yes. It's almost like I didn't continue taking lessons per se when I went to New York, but the lessons were going on all the time if you were paying attention to them. You know what I mean? All it took was going out to hear. I'd got to go out and hear my idols, you know, on a semi-regular basis playing at small clubs and just ride the subway home thinking, you know, should I throw my saxophone away or should I just try again tomorrow? You know, like just constantly faced with that.
Okay, that's great. So I also read on your bio that you've played with many fantastic musicians, one of which is John Mayer.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Again, initially it's a Berkeley connection. We were the same age and we were the same class at Berkeley. So we were both freshmen in the year 96/97. I met him in 97 at a late night recording session that a friend asked me to do as a favor. Literally, like, the session started at 2:30 or 3 in the morning, because that's the only time students could reserve recording studio time back then. So I don't remember, like, I said yes, obviously, but I know I didn't want to. I did it sort of begrudgingly and probably selfishly thinking, you know what, if I say yes to this, it probably won't be that good, but I might get some studio time out of it for myself to record, you know, whatever. And at that session, it was like a couple of guitars, bass, drums, saxophone. It was a very kind of a jammy instrumental funk thing that we did. And the guitar player that asked me to do it is a guy who lived on the same floor of the dorms with me. He's now in the Zac Brown Band. He's been in a lot of different bands. And his other buddy that was there was this guy, John Mayer, who was playing guitar also. They had sort of co-written the song. This guy's name was Clay Cook, or is Clay Cook. And so Clay and John put this together, and that was it. I did this one session, and I thought nothing of it. And then 4 years later, when I was getting out of Berkeley, John's first CD was kind of, you know, starting to make waves. It wasn't even really out on Columbia yet, but it was getting there. And I remember hearing it and thinking, holy shit, this guy's going to be huge. So that's where I met him. But honestly, it was 10 years later when I joined his band. So I met him in 97. I joined his band at the end of 2006 or the beginning of 2007.
Great. And so how long did you end up playing with John and his band?
I don't know. Let's see. I guess over the course of 3 to 5 years. I mean, it was like really a bunch of tours early on, then a few gaps, and then we went back out once or twice more. So up until 2010, 11, something like that.
Great.
And then he shifted gears with his band, changed up a lot and kind of went in a different direction. So I haven't toured with him in a while, but yeah, but we did, it was great.
So I watched some of the videos of you on stage, and I love that you have a great presence on stage, and you really get into it and really, you know, entertain the crowd with your saxophone. Does that come natural? Did you work on your showmanship? How did that work?
Oh, man, not at all. In fact, that's quite flattering that you would say that at all, because I really don't feel that I have any of that. I find it quite an embarrassing place to be. It's like an unfortunate byproduct of the, you know, I love to play the kind of music I play, but I really don't love to be on stage. It's easier, like in a thing where that, what you may have seen with John, you know, those are little golden moments for me where that's the best of all worlds, in that he gave me a chance to do what I do really well in highlighted in small bursts, but I didn't have to carry, like, I wasn't the front man, you know? So that was great. I didn't have to talk. I didn't have to say anything. It also, his band is such a magical place because it is always all about the music. So it didn't matter what we were wearing. There were no dance moves. It wasn't about the fancy lights. It was always about the music. And his audience was, you know, he trained his audience to be on board with that. So it was just this incredible little place. Like, you got to just fully engage with the musicians on stage, the music you're making, and as an extension, the audience, even if that audience was 25, 30,000 people, you could always sense the level of engagement. And as far as like stage presence, I can't say it's anything that I was thinking about. It's just that when you're there in the moment, you know, sometimes like when I see videos of myself, I'm like, oh my God, I look like such a goofball. But in the moment, I'm not thinking about anything other than, you know, trying to intensely connect to the music that's going on right then and there.
Well, I can tell you, as someone who's been in the audience of many concerts, I really appreciate it when artists really get into it and you know, let their emotions go through their music and not just stand there. I was been at a couple of concerts this week, and you can definitely tell who the seasoned bands are and the seasoned performers.
Yeah.
Because they actually allow themselves to get caught up in the music and the mood and just let it flow through.
Yeah, I think. And there's different types of, you know, there's all different types of bands, musicians, whatever. But the kind of, even with John, even though he's like a pop artist on the highest level, his music comes from such a place, like he can jam or he can play his 3-minute really tight radio pop hit. He can do both. And he has a really great sense of like when to shift gears in that way and in within a concert. But, you know, there's no, again, it's not about a rehearsed, like scripted thing. That's what's so fun about it. And the music that I play the most, like, you know, jazz improvisationally based music, it's really about sort of a level of vulnerability where I think in more than anything else, you're able to step on stage and say, okay, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I know we're going to make it good. Let's do it.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So you toured with John for a little bit, and then you then moved from New York to L.A. What prompted the cross-country move?
A number of things. Mostly it was guided by the fact that after being in New York for nearly 10 years, and that was a fantastic experience, my wife and I, at that time newly married, it was sort of like, I don't think we're going to do this forever. I don't see myself raising a family in New York, and we didn't have a family yet, but it just felt like time to go explore some other options. I'd never really thought too much about LA, although while I was in John's band, I became good friends with some of the guys in that band. One in particular kept sort of nudging me, you know, by sending me pictures of 77 and sunny, like screenshots of his weather app when it was like miserable winter in New York. So we took a trip out west. My wife and I took a trip out, and you know, we checked out San Francisco actually first, and then we thought, no, I think we should try LA, and we kept our apartment in New York. And my wife originally is from out here. I mean, she grew up in Santa Barbara, so she has her folks live up there, and we just thought we'd give it a try, and we did for about 6 months, and we didn't look back. I mean, we eventually let go of the apartment in New York.
I mean, besides the fact that there is, you know, supposedly a hurricane coming up the East Coast, it is a very cold day in Boston right now in the 50s. What's the weather like right now in LA?
I'll give you a taste of, I mean, it's always like, well, I shouldn't say it's always the same. Literally, it's been kind of hot recently. Where did my weather app go? It is 79 and sunny, just a whole bunch of you know, yellow suns on this app. Awful.
So much sun. I bet it must be rough. So. Okay.
It doesn't get old, man. It doesn't get old.
Now that you've spent time, so now that you're in LA and working there, I read on the New York Times article about how you created your own website, basically, that is basically helping you through this, make money as an artist. How did that come about?
Yeah. It was a combination of things. It was sort of, the impetus was originally, I think, that people were asking me for lessons, like emailing me saying, hey, I'm going to be in New York. Can I get a lesson? And I wasn't in New York anymore. And one guy said, well, can we do it through Skype? And I said, well, I guess we could try that, you know, and we did. And it was okay. I mean, it worked, but, you know, just like scheduling stuff. And then the technology, I was never thrilled with. It's one thing to talk on Skype, but you bring a saxophone into it and the volume is so different that immediately if you're just using one microphone, it just becomes a quality issue. It's, sure. It's terrible, you know? So I did a few of those and, you know, there was actually one day in particular where I had a guy in, I was trying to batch them, you know, I'll pick one day and I'll do these Skype lessons on one day. And I had a guy in Jamaica, 47-year-old in Jamaica, a 17-year-old in Cork, Ireland, and a 32-year-old in Hong Kong. And scheduling all that was pretty nuts. And on top of it all, at the end of the day, I felt like I basically had the same conversation or small variations on the same conversation with all of them, meaning they all were different ages and different locations, but they all really needed the same information. And the golf pro, actually, the guy in Jamaica, he was the one who said, you know, you should put this, like, you should make these videos so that I could just watch them anytime. And it wasn't like a, you know, one-time deal. And I had been involved in a couple things online, just some early online learning stuff. And it just led to me saying, well, it's worth a shot. Coupled with the fact that at that time, I wasn't touring with John, or I'd just come off a tour, and there was a TV show. I was in the house band on a TV show out here for about a year and a half, and that was wrapping up. And so I was kind of like, what's next? You know, what am I going to do now? And I had this sense of urgency, like, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I should give this a try now, you know, if I want, you know, like I was trying to set it up before everything else on my plate dried up, you know what I mean? And so I sort of got going on it early, and that was I had a few people who I'd been collecting, like, you know, just people who had been asking me for lessons. You know, I had all those emails from those people saved, and it really started small. I mean, I probably had when I first opened up, I probably had a dozen video lessons and a dozen, at most two dozen kind of members to the site.
So did you have any, I guess, coding or web building or training with that?
Yeah. Yeah, I taught myself how to build websites fairly early on, like 1999, I would say. I got my first website, and when I saw the crappy, like, free web pages that they gave you with the domain, I thought, there's got to be something better. And I went out and I bought a book to teach yourself HTML, and I actually got really engrossed in that. I don't know, like, something about, it's not really heavy-duty coding, but HTML is still kind of the building block of so many things. And I really enjoyed doing that. So I started tinkering around. I mean, it was like that moment, the moment you first learn how to write something, and then there's like this code around it. And then when you refresh the browser, it shows you what you know, like, you see on the front end what you just did on the back end. That was a really exciting moment. And sort of got me really interested in HTML. And then I later learned CSS, and I built my own websites. I built websites for bands I was in, a couple of musicians I knew, like, over that decade, sure. You know? So I was pretty comfortable with it and always fiddling with it. So I definitely had some knowledge there.
So your videos, do you host them? Are they hosted separately? Like, do you run them through YouTube first and then link them back, or how do you do that?
No, I don't use YouTube. They're hosted all privately, like through Vimeo, through a professional level of Vimeo. I mean, I've gone through many iterations. I started doing this in late 2010, so video has gotten a lot easier. But yeah, I mean, I used to do it through my own server, through Amazon, through a lot of different things. But now, so they're all hosted, but they're all private. Like, they're all, I can control where they're viewed.
So now that everything is, you know, your site is set up, and going, how do you manage it on, I guess, like a daily or weekly basis? About how many hours do you think it takes you per week to keep up with things?
Oh my God, so many. I mean, I started with 20 something people, and I've been working really hard on this, you know, for years and years, making more and more videos. And it, like, there's a private forum, and I interact and respond with people. And now there's like well over 400 mm-hmm. people and growing. And so I have different challenges now. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to scale without losing the essence of what it is, meaning it's still like a virtual way that people are experiencing lessons with me. I mean, it's not exactly one-on-one. It's definitely not one-on-one, but to directly answer that question, the amount of time, I treat this as a full-time job. I mean, I the way that I treat this thing is like I built my own college, or like I work for a college, you know, as a full-time sure. professor. It just happens to be my own college. So, but the beauty is that I can be flexible with it. So I just came back from a week-long family trip, and, you know, I was able to manage it as long as I had a laptop and Wi-Fi, even in a controlled way. Like I can, in sort of moments like that where I'm touring or on a vacation or something, I can manage it now in small doses. Like in an hour of time, I can handle what I need to handle, or leave it for a few days. But then like this week is going to be a really busy week where I'm playing catch up and trying to get, you know, back sure. on track.
Okay. That's great. I like that you're keeping it out to a full-time job and actually just keeping tabs on things. That's great.
Yeah, it's not meant to be like, it never was meant to be, and it's still not a thing where it's like, oh, I shot a bunch of videos and people just buy them and maybe I make some money from it. It's a very much like, I treat it like a really ongoing career thing. I mean, it's really a foundational thing for me at this point.
Great. I think there was, I can't think of the book right now, but there was a very famous book that talks about how to train yourself in that mindset about how to go from being an amateur to a professional, and you have to start doing things that professionals do. And that's part of that is, you know, treating everything you do very seriously. So I think that's great.
Yeah.
So are there any, I guess, apps or services that you're using right now that help you save time or keep things together?
Yeah, I'm all sort of like endlessly experimenting with that, probably to a fault. But yes, there are a couple that my favorite one recently that I feel like has the most potential, and I'm not fully, I haven't wrapped myself around it yet, but is Trello. Do you use Trello at all?
Oh, no, I haven't. Although I just came across it earlier today. So you're the second person who's talked about it today. So I need to.
It's great. I mean, it in and of itself, it's not that it does like a thing specifically for me, but as a sort of task and organizational management platform, it's pretty brilliant because it's just basically virtual index cards that you can move around in different columns and lists. And so it's endlessly customizable what you want to do with it. Okay. I would recommend following their blog or their Twitter because they do a great job of sort of pointing out a lot of different case studies of the ways people use
sure.
it. But along with that, I'll say two other things. Like probably the most crucial app that I use, like the number one thing that I couldn't live without is MailChimp, because that's like my whole, everything runs on that. Not like MailChimp is the email provider that I use. It, my business doesn't like run in a transactional way through mm-hmm. it, but like without that, I mean, that's everything to me. That's every day for me. I'm dealing with that app because without that, I would have no business. Like that's where all of my people come through me, you know, through an email list, whether they're reading my blog or, you know, they bought something or they're subscribers to my lessons or whatever. That's how I'm able to reach people. So that's number one. And then there's a really cool new app that I've been using a little bit and trying to use more called Zapier. And it basically does very cool things that you used to have to pay a developer thousands of dollars to do. It allows you to basically create, to let other apps talk to one another. So you can do all sorts of things. Like it's based on sort of an if-then theory.
Sure.
Like if somebody emails me and I tag it with this thing, then create a task inside Trello. Or if somebody subscribes to my lessons on MailChimp on this list, then simultaneously remove them from this other list. Things like allows you to automate a lot of manual tasks that you don't really need to hire a virtual assistant to do. Mm-hmm. if you're smart about it, but it's also, you don't want to, you don't necessarily need to be doing this repetitive thing all over, you know, every time.
Yeah. That's great.
So yeah, I would say those are kind of big ones for me.
Yeah. I just started using the If Then app and I love it so far.
Yeah. I've like gone in and out. I've tried that. I recently got back on that, like found my account again and said, maybe I should try this again. Sometimes I have this tendency. My wife is on me about this all the time where like I can have a lot to do. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I always have a lot to do, but let's say I have a ton to do and I have the whole day of my schedule free. And I have this terrible thing that I do where I'll use that time to like research productivity tools rather than just do the work I have to do.
Sure.
You know, like rather than sitting down and going through those 50 emails, I'll be like, I wonder if there's a way that I could automate this thing to that thing. And like next thing I know, 3 hours have gone by and I haven't made a dent in the stuff I have to do.
Yeah, you're not alone. I do the same thing. Oh, and while actually I looked it up, it was Stephen Pressfield's book called Turning Pro.
Stealing my thunder, man. You're stealing my rapid fire quest.
About that. Yeah. Well, then what?
I was like, I was trying not to, when you were saying that, I knew exactly what book you were talking about, but I was trying not to say it.
Okay. I apologize for jumping the gun on that one. Okay. But before we get into that, because actually I'm going to ask you about that in 1 second, I wanted to just see the links. So obviously you spent years studying music and refining your craft and that stuff. Do you think that there are any tricks or habits that you picked up while studying, you know, music and the saxophone that helped you build your business?
I would say, well, yeah, I mean, focus and, this is obviously very specific to me, but not the focus part. Focus just from having to play an instrument well requires a lot of sustained focus over many, many years, but also the ability to improvise, sort of the constant search for learning. Like I guess the parallels that I see are with between the instrument and sort of teaching myself how to build a business online. I would say the parallels are that the ability to focus in small doses over long periods of time, you know, like to really, I mean, I was fortunate that I didn't grow up in an era of all this social media distraction and stuff. Like, I mean, I would used to practice for 4 hours a day and that was no problem. It didn't mean that like for 4 hours, the horn was in my mouth for 4 hours, but to, you know, to just really put your nose to the grindstone and do something. So a lot of focus, then constantly trying to improve and especially in a deconstructive manner. So the way that I learned a lot how to play jazz was by, copying solos of, you know, various jazz master musicians, and so breaking down what they did, like we call it transcribing, but like, you know, figuring out from the result backwards. So like learning what the result was and then trying to figure out, oh, how was this thing built? And that's how I've learned how to build websites too. A lot of you see a cool website and then I go and start to look at it from the back end and go, oh, how is this put together? Okay. So like constantly learn it. Like I think that's why the internet is so addictive to me, because it's just like a library that never closes. You know, I can constantly be like learning new stuff. And then just, you know, the improvisational thing, just kind of being flexible, being able to make adjustments and make them quickly.
Okay. That's great. So if you were to give, let's say, your 20-year-old self advice, if your 20-year-old self was just starting out right now about building a business, what would be your one piece of advice for them that would help them?
I would say trust yourself.
Okay.
Trust yourself more. I guess for me, what I mean by that is that when I look at what I'm doing now, it's so much based on me just being authentically me. And I wish I could have even done that with my music earlier on. Mm-hmm. Like I struggled for a long time. I mean, I probably always will struggle with this, but with the battle of like, what do people think of my playing? Like just and everything, like being a little overly concerned with what I think others are thinking, that other people don't really care anyway. But just, you know, the more that I was able to just trust myself musically and otherwise, like it's just kind of constantly leads to better things.
Okay, that's great.
But I was definitely overly concerned and kind of stressed out my 20-year-old self.
Sure. I think that's, I was very similar in that way too. I think that's just an unfortunate 20-year-old thing.
Because otherwise, I mean, there's like different advice and stuff I could give, but to be honest, that my younger self was, when I look back, I'm actually very grateful, like the way that I was. I was reading business books. My mind was way ahead of where my life was at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was like, I don't know how, there was all these things I wanted to do, but I had no idea how they were going to unfold. So, you know what I mean? It's not like I would go back to myself and say, man, you should really start thinking about the future. It's almost like I was thinking too much about the future. I would say, go back and like, just be a little more present.
Great. So you talked about reading business books. Was that something you were just doing on the side at Berkeley, or
That's from even before Berkeley. Oh, okay. I was into real estate for a while I own some properties, like rental properties. I just knew from a young age, like, I want to do music a certain way. Like, music to me was never, oh, I would like to be a musician. That sounds like a great career opportunity. Yeah. You know, it was like, no, I want to play a certain type of music with certain type of people in a certain type of way, and recognized early on that that was a real kind of outlier of a thing, like a real long shot. So people were always telling me like, oh, what's your backup plan? And, you know, you can't really do, like, you should get a different degree and blah, 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 blah. So I think early on, I just was, I recognized that even at its best, even if I made it to the top of whatever, that it's a roller coaster, and that, you know, there's a lot of hills and valleys to like a music career in general, and certainly a saxophone player, a jazz musician, you know, in particular. Yeah. So I was always looking for, how am I going to even this out? Like, how am I going to provide a platform for myself, some sort of base where my life doesn't have to be dictated by the sort of financial roller coaster of having a career in music.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And it sounds like you're doing a really good job of creating multiple sources of income that can help you with your career.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Even though I already stepped on your toes a little bit with this one, let's jump into the rapid fire questions. Okay. So what is your favorite or most gifted book?
The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
Oh, The War of Art. Great. Well, see, I didn't technically step on the exact one. Just
what? Were you going to say the Turning Pro one?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
That one's okay. I read that. Yeah. It's basically, I mean, no offense to Mr. Pressfield. I think that's like the War of Art started to do so well that maybe there was like some pressure to like, hey, go a little deeper on that. But I mean, I have them both. In fact, I have autographed copies. And the War of Art, I have a multiple copies, so I always have one ready to give to the right person. Mm-hmm. And I think what he says in Turning Pro is basically covered within, you know, 4 to 6 pages of The War of Art. You know, yeah, what you were alluding to about treating your avocation as your vocation, basically, like, you know, he's advocating for, if you're going to be a writer, like, you need to, even if you still have some other job, like, you have to treat this thing you want to do like it was the job you're getting paid to do,
right?
You know? Yeah. That I forget when I first picked up that book. It was maybe in the early 2000s, like somewhere between, I don't know, early on. And that book had a profound effect on me. I was like, I want to get to this. I want to get to this place where I don't have all these other things that I have to do, and my job is what I want it to be, and I can really like work on it like that. But I read that book twice a year just to refresh.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I also own many copies of that, of The War of Art too. But I came across it much later. I didn't come across it until I think like 2009, 2010.
Yeah, it got a lot of like, there's another author you probably are familiar with, Seth Godin.
Yes.
Okay, so I feel like Seth is partially responsible for bringing The War of Art back like to an even more heightened sense of popularity, because he wrote a book called, I don't know if it was Lynchpin, but where he coined the term the lizard brain, which is his version. And he attributes it to Stephen Pressfield, but his version of what Pressfield calls the resistance. Yeah. When I read that phrase where he talks about in that book, the quote unquote, the resistance, this, you know, whenever, basically his thesis is that whenever you have something important to do, when you sit down to do it, the quote unquote resistance with a capital T and a capital R will do everything possible to intervene and stop you from doing that important thing. So this book, you're going to write this book, you will be confronted by the dishes, your messy office, the emails, Facebook, whatever. Like, we all know what these things are. Like, when you're trying to get to do the important stuff, and it's so much easier to do the little unimportant stuff, mm-hmm. you know? So
yeah,
that's the sort of the battle.
Do you have any daily routines or rituals that you do?
I wish I did. I've never really been a routine or ritual person. No 2 days are ever really identical for me. Even the order in which things happen. I mean, outside of, like, I have to get my daughter to preschool at the same time, that's probably the biggest ritual or routine I have. outside of that, no. I mean, even when I practice, I don't have, like, a specific way that I practice the saxophone. Like, I don't repeat the same things every 2 days. I do, you know, there's certain things I like to get to, but I guess that's the part of me that makes me a good improviser.
Sure.
I like to constantly just, like, change. It's a blessing and a curse. I wish I had a little more routine.
I can see that, though. I want to ask about fear and how you overcome it.
Sure. I was talking about this with somebody recently, because I had a moment a week or so ago where I flew back from New York. I'd been performing in New York, and I got back to LA, and some friends of mine were playing in Los Angeles, and I went down to the show, and I heard their first set, and we were hanging out, and they were brilliant, just brilliant musicians, incredible jazz musicians. And the band leader had invited me to sit in the second set. So basically, they played two full sets of music, and I was getting called up at the end to play the last song. So they're all warmed up. I've been traveling all day, had a glass or two of wine, feeling pretty tired. And I was backstage getting my saxophone together and listening to them play out in the front and thinking, wow, I don't think I should do this. Like, I don't think I'm ready right now to just jump out with them, you know, like, jump into the deep end. And I actually experienced this moment where I felt, like, really, not terrified, but just, I've had this feeling so many times over the year, like, so many times sitting in with somebody, meaning, you know, you're just joining them for a song or something. It's not like you're in the band. And, so I considered packing up my saxophone and just, you know, I knew they weren't going to care if I didn't. So it was this little moment I had with myself, and I had to think, you know, what do I do right now? So I definitely was experiencing fear, and I just thought, screw it. You'll be fine. And so, like, I was totally scared and still walked out there. Mm-hmm. And like, the song they were playing that was freaking me out, turned out they wanted me to sit in on the next song anyway. So it wasn't that, but I had to have that, you know what I mean? Like, I'd already made the decision. So that worked out well for me. But I just kind of, there's something you're able to get to, or I'm able to get to, that knows that even though whatever the thing is that's scary, it's like, I'll be able to do it, you know, and just have to do it.
Are there any things that you do, I guess, to practice, like a deliberate practice of getting used to getting out of your comfort zone?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, for me, that experience I just described is always, and probably will always be, something that is a little bit nerve-wracking. Sure. Sitting in with people, just being uncomfortable, and that's something it's like, I'm always doing that in different ways. I guess for me, that is the deliberate practice. Sure. Is like, whether it's going in even with some other people, sitting in with some people around town, you know, again, it's not my show, not my gig, so to speak, but I'll just go and sit in for a few tunes, because it's always a little bit nerve-wracking. You got to step on somebody else's stage and say, okay, what songs do we have in common, or what can we play, or what, you have no idea what's going to happen. If I stopped doing that, and I only ever played in environments where I was assured that I would be comfortable, meaning it was people I always played with and songs I always played, mm-hmm. then that fear would get bigger and bigger and bigger until the point where I wouldn't be able to overcome it. You know, by constantly, throwing myself into those situations, I'm able to sort of keep the fear really tiny and manageable. Okay. But I always have this sense in the back of my mind that, like, if it's been too long, for instance, since being in a situation like that where I've been uncomfortable and had to, you know, face that, mm-hmm. then the fear gets bigger. So I don't, you know, so I try to battle it by not letting it be too long between those instances.
And then lastly, what I want to do is What is one thing that you recommend that the podcast listeners can do to help, that they could do today to get them out of their comfort zone?
I would say, and this is something that I should do more of myself, but like make more personal like connections when you have the opportunities with real people, like in real time. Like, I guess what I mean by that is the amount of times that, for instance, I've seen somebody play a show that I admire at like, and there is a way to approach them, you know, like I'm not talking about like you just saw U2 and like, hey, go talk to Bono afterwards. Right. But let's say, you know, I'm at a small club and I see some musicians I admire play, and then, you know, my own admiration, like I'm like, oh, I don't want to talk to them, they're busy, I should just leave them be. Like my reluctance to go up and say hello or introduce myself, because that would be scary, or is scary to me, and it's always been scary for me, but whenever I do it, it always turns out well, you know. I'm always glad I did. And as somebody who's now been on the other side of it, and I see people come up to the stage and talk to me, like knowing what it's like on that side of it, I would just encourage people to, like, when there's somebody that you know you should talk to, or you know you just want to make that connection with, you know, do it. It doesn't mean that you have to be a pest or annoying, but people are generally more approachable, I think, than I think they are.
Sure.
You know, like I always believe like nobody wants to be approached, and that's me personally. I just, the way that I'm built. But like, you know, don't hide behind, I don't want to say don't hide behind email, like whatever the means is to connect with somebody, cool. But especially if we're talking in person, it could be, you know, for your listeners, it could be like anybody in your life that you just feel like, oh, I'd like to talk to that person, and I can't quite seem to get up the gumption to do it for whatever reason. You know, I think that's a great, it's a really like confidence builder once you start getting better at that.
Okay, great. That's like fantastic advice. Thank you so much. Because I know personally, I also feel like when I'm at concerts and things, and even when I get to actually shake the hands of the artists, sometimes it's really intimidating to just chat with them, because you feel like you're monopolizing their time, or because they've already spoken with like 30 or 50 other fans and they're tired and they just want to get back to their trailer or something.
You know, and I don't mean to shape it as just like at a concert venue. If it just happens for me, that's a relatable space. But I guess it could be at any event. You know, you could be at like some conference, so a podcasting conference, and you see that, oh, I know that guy from that podcast. It's like, go up and talk to them, you know. Or you're at a business, like it definitely does not mean just music related. It's like whenever you're in that situation where you're at a party and you see that person, you know who they are and you'd like to connect, they don't know who you are, and you know, you have to like get over that, like, you know, it's like going to talk to a girl or something. It's like really it can be a really fearful experience, you know. But like from when you're a teenager or something, like, oh, asking somebody to dance, you know, it's like that same feeling, like, oh my God, they're going to just laugh at me and say no, and it's going to be so embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I think that's what the Tim Ferriss thing was getting at too, like just trying to get you over this feeling of the world is going to be all of a sudden like come to a halt and everybody's going to look at you and laugh.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah. When you look at like, what's the worst that's going to happen? The worst that's going to happen is like, honestly, that they'll just say no.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know why that, but even that for me is pretty awful. Like, even though that's the worst that can happen, it's like I have some built-in terror to that result. It's like, oh my God, they said no, you know.
Sure. So,
but it's not that bad.
Well, thank you so much, Bob, for being on the show. I really appreciate it. This has been fantastic.
Yeah, my pleasure.
If the listeners want to reach out to you, what's the best way to do that?
You know, I'm on Twitter. I'm fairly responsive there. Just Bob. It's actually Bob_Reynolds. And my website is, I mean, as far as reaching out to me, my website is Bob Reynolds Music, and that's where all my albums and my online lessons live, there, and my blog and everything else.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much. I will make sure to put that in the show notes so that everybody can get a hold of that and link directly to your Twitter and website. But thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
Cool. My pleasure, Yuri. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Advance Your Art podcast. If you truly enjoy this, please head over to iTunes and download additional interviews, as well as hit the subscribe button so that as new episodes come out, they will automatically go to your phone. Also, while you're there, please give us a 5-star rating, which helps our iTunes rankings. If you'd like to see more information, head on over to advanceyourart.com, where you can find information about each of the guests, as well as projects that I am working on. And always, if you're in the Boston area, please feel free to reach out. I can be found on Twitter at YCataldo, or you can email me, Yuri@advanceyourart.com. Thank you so much, and have a great day.